why don't we get started? I think there's going to be a couple people filing in a little late, but other than that, there was one person who couldn't make it, one who I think fell sick, so pretty much everybody else is here. Everybody get the agenda? Everybody could open it?
Who doesn't have this here?
Some of the things that we already disseminated, and we printed a few things out just in case you forget to print them up and bring them here. One is the mapping thing, which we really need your belly for. So let's take care of some stuff first.
Anyone that didn't get the signing sheet yet?
Joe, thank you so much for taking notes. Everybody should have gotten them, the notes from the last meeting. Okay. Any changes? Okay. Considered approved. The final ATIs that Deb was good enough to tweak and add a few things got emailed, and everybody could open them up. Good?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Good. We're going to be working with that, and we'll probably refer back to it as we look at, you know, what we have, what we need, what we might be using. Deb, do you have any comments on that? I know there was...
No, I don't know if it's exhaustive. You know, as we go through the mapping process, we may think of a couple other things that we can insert in there, but...
And it was, you know, some of it were actually ATIs that we have. Some of them were resources that we may use, and they were kind of meshed together, but we felt that they were all important, so we meshed them together. The system mapping, let me share one thing with you first. This always kind of makes me chuckle. Pat Fischel always used to laugh. It's like she'd go to something and say, oh, we've got this new innovative thing, and they'd find out, oh, it's electronic monitoring. We've been doing that for a long time. The Oswego County Jail seeks alternatives to incarceration as costs soar. And I will scan this in and send it to anybody, but they're looking at building a bigger jail. And they were looking at trying to look at some of the reasons why they were overcrowding. And they said the Oswego County ATI Board was created to address their overcrowding problem, and they are exploring new alternatives such as electronic monitoring and a pretrial release program, which we've been doing for a long time. So once again, you know, we're always pretty much kind of ahead of the game, but I'm kind of proud to say that. But I'll scan this in and send it to everybody, okay, just because it's interesting to know what's happening in the other counties and to know we're not alone, you know, with what people are seeing. The system mapping, which Judge Raleigh sent, did you all get a chance to look at that? Mm-hmm. Because I think that's going to end up being a very key process for us. At the last meeting, we talked about doing a flowchart and finding out from start to finish where our system goes and where our entry points, you know, and where our exit points, and where do we have discretion, and where, you know, do we not. So I think that this is going to be key. And what I thought we would do, and I'm really, Deb and I are open to suggestions, because I haven't done a lot of this, but we have white paper, markers, tape, and I thought we would just put it against that back wall as we go, all right, with our flow chart. And then Maureen in the county clerk's office has a plotter, and she can enter it in and shrink it down, and then we can bring it up each time and look at it and work at it from there. Does that sound doable? I'm open to any other suggestions. I am not real technologically savvy, but it's kind of the old paper and pencil thing. But we can, you know, bring it back every time we meet and put it back up there and work on it from there. So I'm open to suggestions. You done that stuff before?
A little bit, yeah. You know, I think what's going to be interesting is when all of us have different ideas about where there might be inputs, because mm-hmm. I think that the points along the way are pretty standard in the criminal justice system. But each of us may say, yeah, but we could do this at this point, or we could intervene at this point, and things that are not each of us is going to think about. Because we have a big chart at OAR that has kind of the whole system explained for our clients so that they understand where they are, and you know, because it's kind of an overwhelming system. So we've done a little bit of this flow chart thing, but I think that what would be interesting is where does probation come in and where's the DA come in?
That might be a useful jumping off point for the project that Susie was talking about.
Yeah, I'm not technologically good enough to shrink it. It's a big chart. Right. But I did get the basic squares together.
And it will end up, I think, being pretty large. Intricate.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember doing some of this process when we were looking at, you know, developing our action plan in 2006, when mm-hmm. it took us like 18 months to work through this. And we're trying to do it in six. And it was huge. So I think the shrinking factor and being able maybe to, you know, scan it in, make it smaller, look at it, but then add to it, change it, I think that will be kind of key, and it was awfully good of Maureen to offer to do that. I had really hoped the judge would be here. He's probably running a little bit late. He definitely was going to be here. Pat was driving in from out of town, but they have a lot of key information.
Do you want to start?
Do we want to start a
general system? I mean, the legal system isn't going to change. I mean, the steps aren't going to change that
right.
much.
Right.
So we'll just start with the rudimentary blocks
right.
of what happens.
Right. And we have Sergeant Van from the Sheriff's Department who was good enough to come down today to explain to us, you know, some of the starting pieces of that puzzle and how that happens. So I think we should just make the best use of time and we'll jump right in. Do you want to do the honors of doing the white stuff?
Or I'll do the white stuff.
All right, I think it's going to take two. We're going to need the system mapping thing to make sure. Hey, hi. Don't forget to sign that sheet. Thanks, Paula. Excellent. Right here.
Sergeant Van probably knows more about this than I do, this part of it.
It's true.
I conceptualize it as we started the arrest.
Yep.
Is that the way you guys conceptualize it?
That's the way we perceive it.
Right. So that's gonna be a square.
Well,
that's
I'm not too worried about the shapes because we can
right.
We can change the.
You might want it smaller.
Oh, that's true. We have more to scare here. Okay.
Well, yeah.
And how do you?
Okay. Jamie, why don't you tell us?
Sure.
How that transpired.
Well, first things first, we get a call, or we come across something while on patrol, or during our investigation, we discover something, and we get put in a position where we're now placing somebody in custody, taking them, arresting them, and determining whether an arraignment is necessary is the most important part, I think, that you guys are looking for here.
Okay, so we've got, like, either arraignment,
the next
arraignment,
one,
or...
Yep. Yes, you have two options, arraignment or release on appearance ticket.
Release on appearance?
Yep. Appearance ticket or traffic ticket in some cases.
Appearance ticket.
Or
arraignment.
Yep.
Okay. Then from arraignment...
So this is a decision point.
Who makes it? The officer.
Yes, we make the decision.
Okay,
so this is...
In consultation with anybody else?
No.
These are squares?
Are there laws or guidelines that stipulate in certain situations you must go one way or the other?
Absolutely. I'll explain this to you. First of all, a sheriff's office versus a police department are two different elements. A police department in the criminal procedure law can actually take bail on their own accord as a police department. Per certain sections of law or levels of offenses, they can actually take... as a police department, bail from somebody. So you could say, you know, you committed this offense per our policy, $100 bail, and if you appear, you get $100 back. We are not allowed to do that at the sheriff's office. So bail requirement by law. The rules that we follow are in the criminal procedure law under 530 sub 10 of the criminal procedure law itself. And that outlines what offenses require an arraignment, and what offenses do not require an arraignment. And it's pretty simple. Anything D felony or greater, we have to do no matter what an arraignment. E felony is a little complicated. There are certain laws in the E felony, such as bail jumping, which would obviously cause concern if you charge somebody with that, that they haven't appeared, they're jumping bail, that also require arraignment. But about 95% of the e-felonies can be issued an appearance ticket for. And then anything from a misdemeanor, B misdemeanor, unclassified misdemeanor to a violation.
Wait a minute.
Nope.
Bail jumping.
That's just an example.
Right. Yeah. But he said there were very few e-felonies?
Yes, very few.
That
like
are discretionary?
Five.
Okay.
No. Very few that are not discretionary.
Not discretionary.
Right, not discretionary, yes. About 95% you can use your discretion.
Okay. Keep going.
Anything from an A misdemeanor to a violation, we can use our discretion. For example, petty larceny. For the most part, we kick loose with an appearance ticket when they're arrested for that. But then we've got to make a decision when we're dealing with any offenses that use our discretion. What are we going to do? Are we going to arraign or issue an appearance ticket? I'm sorry. And I wrote a few the circumstances down when an arraignment is required. Law enforcement officers cannot issue an order of protection. So if we go to a... nope, not yet. Any kind of assault which is non-domestic or any kind of harassment or any kind of offense against another person where the victim in the case requires an order of protection. We have to do an arraignment because the judge is the only person that can issue that order of protection. So during the course of the arraignment, the judge puts in place an order of protection. That's one time. And
so you said non-domestic assault?
That's with non-domestic offenses. When a victim requires an order of protection, yep.
What would be an example of that?
Fight at the bar, one guy gets assaulted.
And you'd go for an order of protection in that kind of
You'd have to do an arraignment to get an order of protection, yep. Now, domestic incidents are totally different. Every arrest we make off a domestic incident requires an arraignment. And most of the time, an order of protection is put in place by the judge for the victim's sake. That's domestic violence law itself. We have to do an arraignment, whether it's a violation-level offense to an A felony-level offense. Any charge during a domestic dispute requires an arraignment by a judge. Now we're talking more of our discretion as a, you know, as a deputy or as, you know, in my case, a sergeant. And now we got to look at this person and make a determination whether they're gonna we're gonna take this guy for arraignment. Further, one thing we look at is a criminal history. Criminal history tells a lot on a person. Every arrest we do has we attach a criminal history, and the most important thing in here is a little box that says how many failure to appear counts does this guy have against him? How many bench warrants in the past has this guy had for failing to appear for a charge? If there is even one, that's typically causes us to do an arraignment because obviously our goal is to have them appear at court. With any kind of driving offenses also, I put in here. If they are suspended for failing to answer a summons or respond to a ticket, they're showing their failure to comply and failure to respond to a ticket and failure to take care of stuff, and that may also require an arraignment.
If they fail to appear, they've already given an opportunity, issued a ticket, go home, no mm-hmm. arraignment. Then they don't appear. Is that one of the times that the justices, that I'll see a magistrate yes. issue a bench warrant?
Yep, I'll get there. Yep, okay. I've got that.
But this is judgment, right? This is, at this level, we're still at the
Yeah, we're still
the
in the
discretionary
yep.
area.
Okay.
Yep, absolutely. There's several arrest charges itself that are against us that show someone's, or makes us feel that they're not going to appear. And some examples of this would be a case I just handled, unlawful fling from a police officer in a motor vehicle, resisting arrest, anything of that nature where someone's already not complying with the way that the law is outlined, and it's cause enough to us to require an arraignment. So the arrest charge itself, even if it's an A misdemeanor or B misdemeanor or something like that, is also a reason. And lastly I have in here is because of behavior and omissions. Sometimes we'll have people during processing that won't give us their information, won't give us their name, date of birth, social security number, won't let us fingerprint them. It wasn't dispatch show. Behaviors and admissions. Behaviors would be, like I said, you know, they're failing to give us the information, all the information we need to process and complete the arrest. That's an obvious one for us. They're going to have to be brought before a judge, and they actually sit in jail until we get that information from them. And also admissions, part of that. I've arrested many people where they sit there and tell me, well, it's not going to matter anyways, I'm not coming back. And it's like, you know, bells and whistles going off. You're like, all right, well, I was going to give you an appearance stick, but now I got an arraignment. Or I've even had people tell me, well, it doesn't matter because I'm leaving next week. I'm moving to Florida. Okay. You know, that's a no-brainer for us to call a judge and seek an arraignment from him. And as Susie was saying, we're done with the discretionary on where we make the decision as far as an arraignment. I'm the supervisor. Hello. Wrong number.
Sorry, he's on duty. Thank you.
All right, and there's two types of warrants. There's an arrest warrant and a bench warrant. An arrest warrant is where we have charges against somebody, and we have a judge sign those active charges. And a bench warrant is issued when someone fails to appear. Or fails to follow the guidelines of court. And either one of those, whether it's an arrest warrant or a bench warrant, we have to do an arraignment in front of the judge. Bench warrant is more
eye-opening. That's if there's a previously existing bench warrant or...
Right. Well, an arrest warrant, they haven't been brought before a judge. I haven't seen a judge yet. I've drawn up charges on somebody, and I, for one reason or another, can't find him, etc. I go apply with the judge for an arrest warrant.
I'm asking is that what you're talking about is... Here you're in the process of arresting Joe Smith,
yep.
And you're saying if there's a pre-existing bench warrant or arrest warrant, that's
No. We base it on the charge. We arrest people all the time that come to find out they have a warrant out of Ithaca Police Department. We base our decision on our offense or what the case we're handling. If we're dealing with a petty larceny and this guy's got a bench warrant for a D felony, down in the city, well, we're going to treat it with the fact that, okay, we are dealing with a petty larceny. We're not dealing with the police department's case. So we're probably going to issue an appearance ticket, transport him or her down to IPD and turn them over to them. Then they're going to have to do an arraignment. A bench warrant is, either warrant requires us to do an arraignment, but a bench warrant is more important for us to do an arraignment because it's a warrant issued by the judge for their failure to appear or failure to follow the guidelines that the court has laid out. And the judge himself wants him brought back in and issues a bench warrant. So we have to do an arraignment in each case.
Can you give an example of that?
Which one?
The bench warrant.
Bench warrant, we have many bench warrants.
I can give an example of a bench warrant very easily. Recently, a DWI case. And you schedule an appearance, and the person fails to appear.
Mm-hmm.
The person comes in for the initial
arraignment. So they had already been arrested before?
In for the initial arraignment. You go through the arraignment process,
mm-hmm.
rights, attorney, etc., and they fail to appear. Their attorney stands there, and the attorney has absolutely no idea where their client is.
Mm-hmm.
So then the judge will go ahead and issue a bench warrant because the person has failed to comply with the directive of a court to reappear back before that court, so the judge will issue a bench warrant to bring that person back in.
So that means that the sheriff's department has to go get them, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, sheriffs or state police, whoever case it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
A little confused. So if that person, there's a bench warrant that's outstanding,
yep.
gets arrested for petty larceny and Kenny Drugs, do you arraign that person because there's a bench warrant that is outstanding for that person, or do you pursue it as if it is a petty larceny?
Is it our bench warrant out of our office? Bench warrant out of our office? Yeah, we would probably...
If it's coming out of
yep.
Mark's court.
County Ulysses. So yes, it would be our warrant. So we would probably issue an appearance ticket if it's at Kenny Drugs in Truansburg, I'm going to group them together and say, Judge, I've got a petty larceny and this guy's also got a bench warrant. And he'll arraign on both counts. Believe. If it's I pick them up in the Kenny Drugs up in the town of Ithaca by, I think that's Kenny Drugs. We'll put
like Rite Aid or something. Yeah.
I'll probably issue an appearance ticket for the incident that occurred in the town of Ithaca and then take him for arraignment in the town of Ulysses if he's got a bench warrant out of Ulysses.
And there are times when, say, for example, if it's a misdemeanor and it's a contiguous township, I would also do the arraignment on the new charge in conjunction with the bench warrant because I have that jurisdiction. Because the person's already showed his failure to comply with a directive of court to appear, so I would do the arraignment on the petty larceny if I have jurisdiction, but I also do the arraignment on the bench warrant. Mm-hmm.
And you have jurisdiction if it's, did you say,
if it's a
contiguous town?
For a felony charge anywhere in Tompkins County, I have jurisdiction to do a felony arraignment. If it's a misdemeanor level offense, it must be a contiguous township to the town of Ulysses.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
There's a lot of things to consider, but for the most part, we like to issue an appearance ticket because we're a busy office, and transporting them from our office to the town of Ulysses court takes up time, you know, and we got to get back out there. So, yeah, that's true. Yep, that's a good point. One case that I forgot to mention is a DWI arrest. When someone refuses to submit to a chemical test during the course of a DWI investigation, we have to bring that person in front of the judge because that judge has to essentially say, you refuse to submit to a chemical test, you're supposed to, I take your license, you're suspended, and then the judge sets up the hearing with the DMV as far as the suspension goes, which is down the road, probably usually within the month for a DMV.
What do they do with them that night, Jamie, when they're there and the judge is taking the license or whatever? Do they arrange for somebody to come and pick them up because he can't drive?
No, they'll do the arraignment. That's the judge will do an arraignment and make his own decision whether he'll go ahead and do the arraignment and make a decision on bail.
Okay.
So, but usually, yeah.
They can sometimes be released on their own recognizance.
Sure.
So also,
yeah.
They just can't
actually,
drive
home.
Actually,
the majority of the time we arraign people, they're released. Half the time.
But we're getting ahead of our step-by-step process. Right?
Yeah. That's the judge.
I thought that was part of it, released on appearance. Release it.
Well, that would be on the right side, the ROA ticket.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything from like petty larceny
You're right. They're just going
to anything simple, anything we don't have to do an arraignment on, typically we
wouldn't hurt to have a couple more examples of what's something simple.
Like for appearance tickets?
Yep.
What do you give appearance tickets for?
Drunk and disorderly.
Yeah, disorderly conduct. There was a case the other day that we arrested a lady twice in one day for disorderly conduct, and we issued an appearance ticket for both of those. Any kind of trespassing, a violation of trespass, we typically issued an appearance ticket on those. Criminal mischiefs that are non-domestic related. Issue appearance ticket. Say a bunch of kids take a baseball bat to a mailbox. Petty larcenies. Anything of that nature. Anything small. There's not many e-felonies in the penal law, but we don't run into many of them unless they're a lot of some of the fraud cases and some of the DWI cases we deal with. But usually it's just get up here. Yeah. Very misty.
How about like an A misdemeanor assault,
yep,
where the parties just separate, they don't want orders of protection?
That's fine. Yep.
You let them go.
Yep.
Appearance
assault,
ticket.
Assault, harassment, appearance ticket. Okay. But if they want an order of protection,
that changes.
You have to do an arraignment. Okay. Any other questions?
I'm sure there will be some. Would you say that there's big differences in how the sheriff's office versus the police department deals with this?
Which police department?
The Ithaca Police Department.
I think, I don't want to speak on behalf, I'll tell you my my opinion, but please don't take this verbatim. They make their own, they've got their own policies and they follow the same set of guidelines, but they are a a police department versus a sheriff's department. Mm-hmm. They can take bail on their own, whereas we can't. We have to seek a judge for an arraignment for him to take bail. I know Ithaca Police Department, when they arrest somebody for aggravated unlicensed operation, where they have a bunch of failed to appear accounts on their license, and that's why they're suspended, usually they'll take bail. That's the biggest difference.
Wow. Will that happen on the road or back at the police station?
Take them back to the office, and typically. But please don't quote me on that. That's,
what does it exactly mean to take bail?
At our office, the judge does bail.
Right.
The officer, because they're a police department, I don't know why this is. I mean, we do the same thing, but it's just old-fashioned criminal procedure law from the 1920s. But a police department has the power to take their own bail. Mm-hmm. So if they deal with a disorderly conduct or if they deal with a petty larceny and the guy's going to fail to appear account, they have the power to say, okay, you want to go home, we're going to set bail at $250. It's a Class A misdemeanor.
Mm. They can set bail as well as...
Right,
okay.
Yep.
So then that person pays the bail and then is able to go, or if they can't go, they go to jail.
Right, if they can't pay the bail, they have to now seek a judge for arraignment.
Is that also true for, that there's a couple of villages that have a...
Yep, all the police departments can. I know Trumansburg, Lieutenant Hawes does it up there quite often. But I can't speak for any of the other departments.
How about state police?
State police can also.
They can.
So they're a police department.
So let's say they set the bail, $250. The person either can pay it and is released and then has to reappear in front of the judge, or they can't pay it and that's at the point where they would go to jail. When the police department sets the bail, are there guidelines for that?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Violations to unclassified misdemeanors are $100. B and A misdemeanors are up to $250. E felonies are up to either $500 or $750. I can't remember exactly what it is. I want to say $500. Anything above that, by law, it requires an arraignment in front of the judge.
I wonder why sheriffs can't do it.
I think it's just
law.
Old school law.
And I think it's because of the correctional facility, the jails, being attached to the sheriff's office guidelines. Mm-hmm. And also keep in mind, Ithaca Police, they have a separate lockup.
Yeah.
They do have a small
PD, going back to my law enforcement day, I know of people who have been arrested in the city and held in their lockup overnight until court convenes the next morning. So they do have a lockup besides their ability to take bail.
So they could just hold them there until they figure out the bail or the court opens to...
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well,
I'm in the legislature, yep. And we had a number of people asserting that people were being arrested and put in jail for simple possession of small quantities of, say, marijuana. Is that...
Impossible.
Yeah.
A small possession of marijuana would be unlawful possession of marijuana. It's a violation. It's a non-custodial arrest. We have no right to arrest them and arraign them. So that's... It's impossible. A supervisor would step in if someone took them into custody for a violation.
What small quantity?
Anything less than 25 grams.
How much is that?
A bit less than an ounce.
Okay.
Sandwich bag.
That may be a poor example, but petty larceny.
Yep.
There are a lot of folks who are out there right now on petty larceny who weren't issued an appearance ticket. They were...
Yep.
Bail was set.
I've seen... probably over 200 petty larcenies come through our office since I've been there. I've seen probably 3 arraignments in those petty larcenies. I've done 1 arraignment on a petty larceny because of the person's criminal history showing personally. It may be on a bench warrant for their failed to appear account on a petty larceny.
Are they coming in from the city of Ithaca?
I doubt it. I mean, it's pretty traditional to just hit them with a... appearance ticket, as long as they're, cooperate, they don't say anything, such as I'm leaving the state tomorrow, or...
That's strange, because I just...
One of the things that we might be able to look at is some of the ones that show as petty larceny, and maybe there are
multiple counts with it that are also a misdemeanor. I know when they capture them at the jail, they try to capture the most severe, but it doesn't show all of them. Like, it might say petty larceny,
and
but
resisting
they
arrest
can,
or something.
Yeah, they could have a resisting arrest. They could have a bunch of other stuff with it.
Yeah.
It's just that they're all a misdemeanor, so it just depends on whichever one you took first.
I'm not sure. I would highly doubt that it was an arrest that we made. It wasn't.
Solely
we very rarely ever bring anybody before a judge on a petty larceny. And if it is, it's because we've had the professional thieves that come into the area from like Syracuse and Binghamton and Rochester that are professionals. That's what they do. You know, they go in there and they steal a bunch of stuff. And they steal like $950.
Right,
and they're from out of town. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's going to, you know.
Is 1,000 the threshold from petty to grand larceny?
Yeah.
How many decades has it been since that number changed? Anybody know?
A long
number change, as far as I know.
Yeah. So that inflation gradually.
Talk to the state legislature.
It means that in terms of absolute value, grand larceny gets cheaper and cheaper.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You can look at it that way.
Talk to the state legislature. Change.
Yeah, I know.
But these are the kinds of points where good data, we're going to be having some data going to CJATI.
Right.
And then it'll come to this committee, too, so we can see how many are in there on which charges.
That would be good information to have. But just see if you can, if you do get that information, just make sure you can see if it's on a bench warrant. Because if they're in there on petty larceny, I guarantee it's because there was a bench warrant they failed to appear.
Okay.
I can almost
or the petty
that.
Larceny wasn't the only charge they're in.
Right.
Sometimes they'll do impersonation.
Criminal impersonation.
Yep.
A couple of those. And I've got a couple of the professionals as clients.
Yep.
And they would usually frequently do that in addition.
It was
sorry, what's criminal impersonation?
They give a
false
another person's name identification. Mm.
If we arrest somebody for that, it's a no-brainer. False impersonation or criminal impersonation.
You know, it was interesting when you said that, Jamie, because for the kids, which is what I'm more familiar with, under, you know, the 700 section on the Family Court Act, CPS has to get involved and the officer has to take the kid into custody as a runaway when they won't tell them who they are, they won't tell them where they live, they won't tell them who their parents are, and we have to put them in detention because we don't know who they are. So it's kind of a safekeeping thing. So it's analogous into the adult system, which I find that was pretty interesting.
There's so many different ways that stuff comes up. I mean, we see warrants that are like, you don't even require an arraignment. A parole warrant, for example. If someone's on state parole and their parole officer issued a warrant, you don't even bring them before a judge. They go right to jail.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many factors that it's very difficult for me to sit down with you people here and just say, all right, this is when we do it, this is when we don't do it.
Right.
These are the set guidelines. This is, you know, exactly how we do it every single time.
So what do you use, I mean, other than memorizing this just because you were experienced, but how did you learn it?
How did I learn it?
If we wanted to study this so that we understood better, how did you learn?
I would go, first of all, I would look at the criminal procedure law regarding the, and I want to say, like I said, it's 530.10 regarding bail being set.
It is. Okay.
As far as when it's required by a law for us to do an arraignment.
Okay. 530.10 covers most of what we're talking about.
Yep, and that's the beginning point.
Okay.
And then from there, it's you know, everybody at our office has good judgment. And if they're telling me they have to take this person for arraignment, there's a reason why this person is going for arraignment. And I'm telling you right now, if we don't have to arraign somebody, we don't want to arraign somebody. To begin with, we don't even want to arrest people. You know, that is not our goal. Sometimes, like drunk drivers or suspended drivers, that kind of stuff, or catching a burglar in the act. Yeah, we're trying to be proactive and stop these things, but someone calls in an 18-year-old kid that just stole a pocketbook from, you know, the mall. We don't want to go there and arrest him, but we have no choice because it's mall security's choice or target security's choice, loss prevention's choice, and we have to act on that. But we don't, you know, any kind of complaint work, we don't enjoy arresting people, and if we can resolve it in any different way, we try. But, you know, sometimes we just got to make that judgment call, and that... I can tell you, our guys, their discretion is very good, and I trust every one of them to make that call. And if they tell me they've got somebody that has to go for an arraignment, that's That's it. There's a reason why. And I can assure you it's a good reason.
Do you ever see a situation where it's not a discretionary case, but the guidelines or the rules or the law requires you to do an arraignment, and you think, this is dumb. We don't really need an arraignment here, but if it weren't for the law, we wouldn't bother
doing
it. What kind of situation would that be?
Any kind of defelling where we have to do an arraignment, any kind of warrant where, you know, that the guy came and turned himself in. Hey, I'm here. I just realized that I forgot the appearance day. My attorney called me. I have a warrant. I'm here to turn myself in. I got taken for a ring. Stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Where you're like, this guy just, I wish I could just sit here and scratch out an appearance ticket. You got to appear at a different date, but by law, we're required to take him for a ring. Some D felonies I can't think of, you know, but when you get up to like C, B, A's and the felonies, I mean, there's a reason why. I mean, that's a good person to bring before a judge and have him incarcerated, because the steeper the charge, the more likely they are to flee.
Right. And keep in mind, like, I think Judge Riley hit on the last meeting, anything like a D or above, typically they contact the DA's office for a bail recommendation. So when that defendant comes to the court, the judge is told what the recommendation from the particular ADA is.
What did you call the recommendation? A fail?
Excuse me?
Did you call it, what kind of recommendation did you call it?
No, for bail.
Oh,
for bail. It's a recommendation for bail. The DA's office is contacted by the arresting agency, who the DA will review the case over the phone with the officer and then say, I want $5,000, $10,000, you know, secure bail bond, or $15,000, $30,000, or whatever they said they want as far as bail.
So then at arraignment, there's two choices. I mean, there's three options, right?
Yeah, and Mark can speak to this.
I have no authority to do this.
You don't?
I don't.
Which judges do have the authority to?
The people, who is the DA's office.
Right, they can dismiss.
They can make a recommendation to the court for dismissal. But that never happens at arraignment.
No.
That happens later on, usually in the court proceedings. Mm. The only summonses, I mean, going back to traffic tickets, I have the authority to dismiss, are like equipment violations, where a person is issued a ticket for no taillights, no headlight, things of the, no muffler, whatever, and they, it's called a fix-it ticket, and they are given a repair document, they take to a repair garage, and that person affirms under penalty of perjury has been fixed. Then I have the authority to dismiss that particular ticket. But anything above and beyond that, I don't have the authority. I have to have the recommendation from the DA's office or the people to move for dismissal or a reduction.
I knew of a case of a young man who had prescription medication, but it didn't have the label on it, and then he was able to show that it was his prescription. Would that be under a fix-it ticket, or does that fall into okay?
That's only a fix-it ticket is only for vehicle and traffic violations.
Oh, vehicle only. Okay.
And like mostly your lighting defects and things of that nature.
Got it.
Where they're allowed to have them fixed within a 24-hour period.
It seems like we skipped a step here. That after arrest and before arraignment, there's a decision about which court to take someone to for arraignment. And I'd like to, I don't fully understand what the rule is.
If Judge Dresser wants to add to it, it's pretty simple. We start with the court where the incident or the warrant is out of, and we go from there. I'd say 90% of the time we call our dispatch center, and they're the ones that call out and reach out to the judges to set up the arraignment time. And that's tough for a judge because, you know, they get called 3, 4 o'clock in the morning and have to come out for an arraignment. But it starts centralized in that township, and then it goes to adjoining. If you can't reach all, if you go through all the adjoining towns, you go outward. It goes from there. But usually you can contact the town judge where the incident or the warrant's out of, and if you can't, one of the other judges.
Okay, but it's like there's two town judges in each town, right?
Not always.
No? There's two town judges in some towns. And if you're not going to the judge in that town, you have a choice of which contiguous town
yeah.
to go to. Who's making that choice, the arresting officer or the dispatcher?
It depends. Sometimes the judge wants to know the name of the individual and get the information. But I'd say 80 to 90% of the time, our dispatch center is the one that calls out to the judges. It's easier on us to say, hey, you know, I'll call 352 times, you know, and I'll say, can you reach Town of Ithaca judge for an arraignment? And they know that means if they can't reach the Town of Ithaca, they go from there. They try different judges surrounding it. So it's usually not us that makes that phone call, and then they'll say, you know, all right, Judge Dresser, he'll be there in 20 minutes. Okay. And then you try to make the best to get there. Or he's next.
Do you know if that process is the same in the other police departments?
I would say no. Ithaca Police Department, they typically reach one judge.
Yeah.
And if not, they can hold them. They go off different guidelines, or one or two judges. I'm not sure how many city judges there are.
Well, we one and a half, but soon to be two.
We don't deal with city judges because unless we make an arrest on a proactive case, where we actually like, stop somebody with drugs in the car, we stop somebody in the city with their drunk driver. But there are any warrants or anything, or 99% of cases are handled by the city of Ithaca, so that's, we don't usually work with the city judges. But.
Anyhow, Pat, going back to your question regarding arraignment, primarily like my decision when a person's brought in, if we're going back to arraignments, is either release on their own recognizance or remand.
Yeah, okay.
Those are the two options that are available at arraignment.
Not bail?
Remand, bail. Bail and remand. That's what I mean. That's part of the bail decision process if you're going to remand somebody.
I might be getting ahead of myself, but are there instances where you don't set bail?
The person has, again, based upon their criminal history, if a defendant has two felony convictions, a town judge is not authorized to set bail.
Okay. So even if they've served out that time and
it makes
yeah,
a difference.
Okay.
If they have two felony convictions, a town justice is not allowed to set bail. However, again, like a homicide case, murder case, I'm not authorized to set bail. A person is remanded without bail until it's heard before the county court.
Does it matter what level the felonies are?
Excuse me?
Does it matter which level the felonies are? Can they be E's, D's?
It's two felony convictions. I think it's
no,
any
it's
level.
No, just two felony convictions. I cannot set bail. And that's one thing I look at when a defendant comes in with a criminal history. I go through their criminal history and look at that and make a determination before I even go to the aspect.
Mm-hmm. That's set by law.
Do I understand right that both the arresting officer and the judge have access to a criminal justice database that's going to give criminal history instantly if you've got ID information on the person?
Generally, we bring it to the judge in the arraignment.
You bring...
A copy for him.
The criminal history copy.
Criminal history.
Print it out.
In fact, it just happened today.
We have access to the court to do that, but typically if I come in at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm more in tune to getting things ready for the arraignment because I know the criminal history is coming. Yeah. I do have access to run that through the court. An example, Sergeant Van just asked me to sign a warrant of arrest while I was here. And attached to that warrant of arrest is a criminal history, so I can look at that and see the person's pedigree information even prior to seeing that person.
So in the case of someone with two felony convictions, if it goes then to the county judge can decide to set bail, right?
What happens, it doesn't go right to the county court judge. It still stays in the local town court for other preliminary hearings.
Preliminary hearings.
And then once that is either, it's a felony hearing, which is an entitlement for the defendant to have in a local town court. Once that hearing is completed, the defense counsel has the option to waive the hearing, or you actually have a hearing before the court, and the judge will determine whether there's sufficient cause to hold the action over for action before the Tompkins County Grand Jury. At that time, then the case is transferred down to the county. Whether the defense counsel waives the hearing, or you actually have the hearing before the court and make that determination, then the case is transferred down to the county court for indictment to the grand jury.
Is an attorney there at the arraignment always? right?
Not always.
Not always.
I think Judge Ali spoke, there's a pilot program in the town of Dryden right now.
Right.
Where there's been some talk about having attorneys at every arraignment, no matter what time of day it is.
Right.
And it's a pilot program that one township now is going through that to see if it's going to work or not.
But the Chief Justice of the state of New York is saying that that's the standard. And
it's
so
coming.
It looks like it'll be coming to
it's
across
coming.
All townships.
But what they have to arrange is to have on-call attorneys
right.
in certain townships that are going to come out at 2 or 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. Because one of the largest concerns from the magistrates was, okay, I'm called at 2 o'clock in the morning for an arraignment, and the attorney doesn't arrive until 5 a.m., and I have a full-time job, or I must be at work at 7 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to sit there and wait for 3 hours for an attorney to show up for the arraignment.
I know what they're talking about. It's taking the 18B list. Those are the attorneys who take assigned mm-hmm. counsel and dividing it geographically mm-hmm. so that there be... And one thing you could do is you could require that as part of becoming part of that panel, of being on the 18B, that you agree to take arraignments at whatever hour.
What's coming? I mean, I think it's a good idea because it makes a difference as far as at least my decision whether I'm going to set bail or not set bail.
Mm-hmm.
If I have counsel present in court who can take the defendant under their wing, per se, and have a good bail argument, then I'm more inclined to release or at least have a lower bail than what I would normally set at the normal time of arraignment.
But the attorney only has as much time as you have to look at that person's
mm-hmm.
charge
mm-hmm.
and criminal history and all of that.
Right.
Well, I mean, they don't know the client ahead of time is what I'm asking.
No, but you would talk to the you would
talk
to the defendant when you get there.
We wouldn't have their criminal history until we got to the court.
Right.
Just, you know, the client can tell us something and they might not even remember their entire history.
So if I'm a judge in the town of whatever, about how often am I going to get that call to do an arraignment after
hours? As I indicated at the last meeting, Eric, like with me, it's if I'm called out 2 or 3 times a month, that's a lot.
Okay.
I want to say it like grassroots.
Yeah.
I live there.
Yeah.
Okay. In the normal time, like last month, I think it was one time last month.
So in some of the more densely populated towns, it might be a little more than that. But in Carolina, it might
very
be
well
less.
Possible. I have a village, you know, in the town of Ulysses, so which has a very active police department, but. And like maybe Cuba Heights, I can't, or the town of Ithaca, you know, you have a higher population. I can't speak for them. I know for the town of Ulysses, it's once, twice a month, unless you have a special event going on.
Susan?
Is the, you can't, at the arraignment, you can't dismiss unless the people recommend. Does that mean there's somebody on call at the DA's office whenever?
Mm-hmm. Nothing ever gets dismissed at the initial arraignment. The initial arraignment is just bringing a charge before the court, period. And then the matter is adjourned, and you have arraignment with counsel, unless it's a violation-level offense. But typically, how I do business, if it's a misdemeanor-level offense, the person's arraigned, they're ROR'd or remanded in lieu of bail, matters set for arraignment with counsel, that's the very next step, is they had to defend it back with counsel. If the defendant's still in jail, they're brought from the jail back to the court. They meet with their attorney. They're arraigned with counsel. Then there's a decision made based upon bail arguments by defense counsel, whether the person is released from custody or still remanded. And then the process starts to go from there. And then, like in my court, there's I hold court every week. And then one day a month, I call it ADA, a pretrial day, is when the prosecutor's in my court. Which that's a very busy court day because all your cases that are criminal cases are stacked up for that one particular day. I may have 45 people in court on a given day on my ADA or pretrial day. That's when the attorneys begin to negotiate the charges before the court and they try to reach a plea agreement or motions are filed or the matter is set for trial. That's when that begins to be spoke about at that point in time.
My question was, when the sheriff pulls somebody over mm-hmm. and chooses to take them before the judge, what do you call that first time that they appear before them?
Arraignment.
Arraignment.
That's their initial arraignment before the court on those charges.
And what you said was that when they appear before you, you cannot dismiss anything without the people recommending it.
That's correct.
So my question was, as that person stands before you and you're just trying to decide what to do, does that mean that you can be in contact with a representative of the district attorney's office? Or are they available
for that?
The only
time that we require, if it's a felony level offense and the person is being arraigned on a D or above felony charge, typically the police department will contact the DA's office for a recommendation of bail. Otherwise, it's my decision what I do with that person.
And if you can't reach the DA?
I've never called the DA.
If the DA doesn't respond to his call? So in other words, you don't hear from the DA, and so you don't have any input from the DA.
Then I take it upon myself to review what information I have. As I indicated, I think a couple of meetings ago, I look at the criminal history, and I have a complete list of questions I ask that person about residency, family, employment, prior convictions, prior arrests, parole, probation. I go through the entire gamut of questions before I make a decision with respect to bail.
Got it. Thank you.
Joe.
So, Mike, there's an arraignment with counsel. And then you said something about a court date that may happen. You do it once a month. The DA is involved. So if I'm off cycle, if I'm arraigned with counsel today, and you just had your once-a-month thing yesterday, is there a chance that I am kind of waiting for the next court date?
You're going to wait 30 days,
yeah,
typically.
And if bail is high, I'm going to be waiting in jail.
That's correct.
For that 1 month.
That's correct. Which is not a very typical situation.
Okay.
Because
when defense counsel's there, as Jason can attest, you know, they're a very distinguished person to be in court, and they are representing the defendant, and they usually have a good argument, and I put a lot in defense counsel say that I will make sure my client appears in court at the next court appearance. Again, going back, initially when I arraign someone, I may have very limited information about that person. I may not have a criminal history, and I may only have what questions I can ask that person to make a decision whether I'm going to set bail or not. So if I do set bail, say $5,000 cash bail, the person's brought back, and I bring them back usually as soon as I can, within at least a week, my next court appearance for arraignment with counsel. And I'll have my clerk speak with assigned counsel to make sure there's an attorney assigned so that there's no delay there. The person comes back in the court. The counsel has a discussion with me, makes bail arguments, and I've never had an attorney yet say, I can't guarantee my client's appearance. I'll make sure my client is here. Here's his cell phone. Here's his home phone. This is where he lives. He lives with mom and dad. And that makes a lot of difference as far as my decision whether I'm going to make that person stay in jail or release them. Typically, I release them.
So, in effect, the new possible emerging requirement to have a counsel at the initial arraignment could reduce our jail costs.
That's why I said way back in the very beginning. Mm-hmm. As a possibility. And I've had, and that's not been many, and I think it's only been DWI arrests. I think I've had 3 DWI arrests in the later evening hours, 8, 9, 10, 11 o'clock, where I've had the defendant call their attorney and come in at the initial arraignment on the DWI charge with their attorney. And I have not remanded because I know the attorneys. Mm-hmm. They're in my court quite frequently, and I trust their professional ability. And when they say, I can guarantee my client will be here next week, I release them.
So if I can modify the question that Joe was asking a few minutes ago, if not the lag from the initial arraignment until that once-a-month appearance we were talking about, it's the lag from the initial arraignment to arraignment with counsel, where someone may be doing up to a week of jail time.
Say, I'll give you an example. Say, for example, I arraign a person tonight, and my court is next Tuesday. And the person comes in, they're arraigned, they have a horrendous criminal history, they've got multiple bench warrants, and that person's remanded to jail. I will not see them until next Tuesday morning.
So if we're looking at reducing jail population, if there's a way to shrink that window, that might be one thing to look at. It's not obvious to me how we shrink it, but it's at least something to look at.
As far as cooperation with judges coming to court more often, I'm not sure how that would work out. But that's one of the things I looked at. And I'm very diligent when I do arraign somebody to look at the calendar. And I've set cases on non-court days to bring the person back. And because I just felt more compelled to have that person come back with their attorney. Again, like in cases that require felony hearings, you have a certain number of hours to bring the person back for a hearing before the court. So quite often, I'm there on non-court days with people who were brought in from jail for the purpose of arraignment with counsel or for the felony hearings.
Jason, you're shaking your head. Give me your thoughts.
Because I just had a situation like that in Lansing where Judge Howell brought someone back early because they were on a non-court day for me. You know, a lot of times, some of the judges, if we request it in your time, you know, they'll do it.
And also keep in mind, just to bring up quite often, you know, probation is a great asset for the town judges. And if I arraign somebody and they are, in fact, remanded, quite often, if it's on a business day, I'll have a report from Burnham and Stranger, usually within a day or two, on my desk, what their recommendations as far as bail is. I do have the authority, without even bringing the person back to court, to issue a different securing order, either reducing that bail or to ROR them. While that person coming back to court, I can do that.
Interesting. Okay. And I know Bernadette goes up there every day.
Every day. Yeah. Every day.
She goes up every day. She says she misses
Bernadette
very...
Works for
Bernadette works for probation. Okay. Yeah. And she goes up every day and then gives preliminary information to the court on... You know, what do you typically get from Bernadette, Mark?
Well, it's
they look at the family.
Quite often, she'll make a recommendation either for ROR, reduced bail, release under supervision or probation. She'll actually interview the defendant, and they'll actually sign a contract accepting the terms and conditions of release under supervision or probation. So I'll have that within usually, I would say, 48 hours on my desk from her.
That's you say she goes awesome. In every day. Is that every day or every weekday?
It's every weekday.
Every Monday through Friday.
It's every weekday.
She usually gets family information. Too.
Yes, yes.
So,
family resources, yeah.
Yeah. Or if they have roommates or something. Just, it's usually pretty good.
So is she a probation officer or is...
Yeah, yeah. She's not a probation officer, but she's like a probation officer... assistant, trainee, something. But she goes up and that's what she does. She's been there for a long time. A long time.
I'm gonna head out because I'm running the shift tonight. Does anybody have any questions for me before I go?
We'll probably ping
you. If you do, please get a hold of me on my email. I washed my uniform last night and I left all my business cards in there, so.
If somebody does have questions, forward them to me and I will make sure they get to Jamie or whoever the chips.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you
for your time.
Thank you,
Jamie. Thank you.
Hope it was.
Yeah.
I learned a lot. I've been doing this for a long time. Thank you. Thank you very much for your time. So I think what we need to do, we're going to have to clean this off. Figure out where discretionary points are, where decisions. What did anybody hear tonight that might make you think, oh, there might be something that we could try to change to maybe get a... I mean, like, I'm sorry, Pat's not here, she'll kill me. But I'm thinking if we had somebody going up to the jail maybe Saturday, Sunday, you know, and getting the information to the judges, maybe we'd cut off a few days, I don't know. If the magistrates or the judges would find that even more helpful, it's, you know, cost-benefit analysis. But I'm just thinking, you know, like that as we're going through the process. Did anybody else think?
Well, I do think the thing that Mark talked about was getting the attorney there at the initial arraignment is an important
first
step.
That sounds like it
could
be a B+.
As far as reducing time and the like.
We ought to write that down. We ought to start writing these ideas down and things we might want to explore because these are some of the things that we are supposed to look at.
One of the magistrates' meetings was the issue of the delay with having the attorneys respond. Especially with, you know, I'm lucky I'm retired, but I do a lot of stuff on the side, but a lot of the judges still work full-time, you know, with daytime jobs. So to have a judge be called at 2 o'clock and no attorney until 5 o'clock is going to be a great hardship on that judge to sit there for 3 hours waiting. So that's a lot of the things to work through the system of having counsel present.
Yeah, and sometimes if they have, rather say they already have an attorney to retain or other things that they call you to, they may need to wait for that person who might not even be in the area, so they might not want someone from the ATMB list.
Right, somebody different. They might want their retained attorney.
Yeah, well, that's and the other thing.
They might be conflict out, too, on other charges. Conflicts.
Yeah.
In that case, sir, I've had many defendants, you know, in going through the assigned counsel process and the application say, well, I want my attorney is this person here. Well, I'm not going to sit there and wait, you know, for that until daylight for that attorney to come to his office to come to court. And typically, I bring that case back to court sooner than I normally would with arraignment with counsel.
Does that hearing have to occur in your town? So if the event occurred in your town, does it have to be brought back to your town court?
Yes.
So you can't enter into some kind of an understanding with surrounding towns?
For the initial arraignment, say, for example, if I issue a warrant, the Ulysses, Enfield can do the arraignment. Lansing can do the arraignment, Ithaca can do the arraignment, but anything as far as actual court proceedings where the case is before my court, I'm the judge of record, or per se. There have been occasions, like with Judge Schley, he may issue a warrant, he's not available, he'll call me and say, can you do the arraignment? I'll go up and do the arraignment for him, but it stays within that township if we can work that out.
So, Ulysses and Lansing.
Paula.
Yes.
Paula, and then
the lake.
Eric. That was a huge discussion years ago, I heard. I was looking for an arraignment back when I was an investigator, and I called a Lansing judge, and it was actually a Ulysses case. He goes, well, we don't adjoin. I said, well, somewhere there's a line in the middle of Cuba Lake where Lansing adjoins.
Little flags on the bridge.
Paula.
Is the arraignment, initial arraignment judge and then the judge of record, does that judge of record get established at the arraignment with the defense counsel?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so.
Say, for example, when I do the arraignment, the case is mine. Now, just to jump off the bridge here a little bit, if I do. Say, for example, I do an arraignment for the town of Ithaca. I have two options. I have the option to keep that case because Ithaca is a contiguous township. I can keep that case in my court even though the crime occurred in the town of Ithaca, or I can refer that case back to the town of Ithaca for a later appearance. And example on quite a few of the different felony cases that I do arraignments on, I'll just keep the case because the defendant comes in, the defendant's arraigned, I have to schedule a felony hearing within either 120 hours or 144 hours, a hearing before the court, and it's so much more simplistic just to keep that case because of the time constraints and trying to refer it back to a different township for the defendant to go in and have that felony hearing set. And then, recently, I've just been keeping the cases that come into my other township. It's so much easier because the defendant comes into your court, you're familiar with the defendant, you know who defense counsel is, you've done the initial arraignment, so I just keep the case.
So the only time that you wouldn't be able to keep the case is if the two felony convictions, if they had two prior felony convictions.
Any felony conviction, any felony arrest that comes before my court, I don't have jurisdiction over that felony case only for arraignment and the preliminary hearing.
Ah, okay.
Those are the two items I have jurisdiction over that once either the felony hearing is waived, or we actually have a hearing, and I establish there's just cause to go before the Tompkins County Grand Jury, then the case is transferred down to county court.
Sorry, one more question. So would you say that in the volume of cases that you see, that it's common for people with former convictions or former felonies to come through? I mean, in other words, I'm trying to see if one of the places where people are being held in jail has to do with the specificity of what happens if you have a serious previous record.
Actually, I think I can say in my whole time, I think I've had two people in my third year that had two felony convictions prior. I mean, that's
so it's uncommon.
Out of all the cases I've had.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least in that town.
At least in that town.
I wonder about the other one.
This is where I wish was Judge Rowley's not here, but maybe.
I know. I'm surprised.
Maybe we can do this again and think about it through the city.
Eric.
Something I'm aware of, let me see if I can articulate this, is that when someone is, when a police officer appears at the scene of some event, usually there'll be no arrest. And if there is an arrest, usually it'll be an appearance ticket.
That's what it's saying. Right.
And if it's not an appearance ticket, it'll get taken to court for arraignment, in which case it'll usually be a release on recognizance. But if it's not, there's going to be a remand with bail set. And then usually the person will be able to make bail. So each time where we're taking off the largest fraction and leaving this little wedge, which means that every single person that's in the jail, certainly every single person that's in the jail for more than 48 hours, has already missed the boat on a whole series of usuallys. And what I'm concerned about is that then when we hear people who work in one or another capacity in the system talking about what they usually do, which is good, it's hard then to get, how does it come about that we have somebody who misses the boat on each of these things that usually happens? There's going to be some unique set of circumstances on each of those cases that explains why it didn't play out the way things usually do. And I think that's what we somehow need to get a handle on if we're trying to figure out how to shrink that pool of people who aren't the usual.
But I think we also heard from the sheriff's department, mm-hmm. so it's important for us to understand that that's one slice of
right.
who's up there in the jail.
Right.
So that there may be different sets of usualies from IPD, from Trumansburg Village, from Cayuga Heights.
Mm-hmm.
But I think those are good questions because I'm kind of shocked that if the jail's so full, if the vast number of people are issued RORs, if they're even arrested to begin with. Then we've got a lot more crime going on than we're capturing.
I think the other consideration is, again, and we've talked about this, the actual jail population, what is the elements of that population? Mm-hmm. Parole, how many felony offenders are currently incarcerated, what level of offenses that you have that would precipitate that incarceration rate that we currently have versus what the town courts deal with or what different agencies deal with on a daily basis.
That's the data that we had a little bit last summer that we really need back again because...
That's what we're going to be looking at the next CJATI meeting. And then from there, we're going to take the pieces, and I'm hoping the task force people can come, and we're going to take some of that into the next task force meeting. And in between that, or before or after that, we've got to think about scheduling the public meeting, you know, to hear any new ideas. So that's going to be, you know, process that we need to talk about. And I it's almost like I'm hearing, too, that maybe we want to hear from the city. Who do we want to hear from?
What do you
I think we...
So we want somebody
city
from
and
the
a judge
department?
From...
I can ask.
I mean,
the judges or the police department, too.
I mean, the same conversation, but from the city perspective. And I want to, mm-hmm. I'd be very curious to see if there's differences in the way that they handle things. And if there aren't, I mean, the data should be able to tell us what percentage of those who are in jail already had previous warrants. I mean, because it sounded that there was this checkbox that it automatically, if you had that, whether they wanted to or not, based on that specific offense that was happening now, they had to take you in, which is why I'm wondering if the people with a lot of previous records or outstanding warrants or failure to appears, that's the main reason why the people are getting taken to jail as opposed to the specific offenses or class of offense.
But if I understand correctly, the data isn't good enough to tell us that.
I don't think that we have...
We're working on the data. We're going to be able to do a lot of slicing and dicing here. We want to make sure it's right before we share it. So it's being vetted right now through all the appropriate places. It won't be able to do everything you want to do.
Right.
Okay. Just because What we're trying to do is pull data in from the booking system called Black Creek. As you're being booked, you've been there, a whole lot of things about you are being entered into that system. So we're going to be able to use the data that is being captured there to give you some statistics. Again, some of the stuff that you're looking for is it may not be possible to do. I believe that in the system, we can look at how many charges were issued against that individual, and we try to sort by highest charge. Because if you want to look at statistics and make sense of them, you can't look at 800 or so people who have been to the turnstile and look at each of the 6 or 7 or 8 charges against those individuals and make any sense of it. So we've keyed on highest charges. What we'll try to do is to look through some that seem to be high turnstile charges. Petty larceny, for example, shows up a lot. So what we heard tonight is you better look underneath those numbers, because people don't go to jail. They don't. Even the unsentenced inmates aren't there because of petty larceny. There's other things going on.
Semen.
Well, yeah, that's so that's what we got to do. See if we can lift the hood even farther and dig down in and see what's going on.
And we can't access the criminal history that the police can, so that we can't really figure out what's going on with a criminal history. We can't really identify in any scientific way who does have all this history.
But we have to remember that if Bernadette is going up there and making recommendations, they have that history or not? Does she have that history or not?
Probation can pull a police.
But that would be a way to deal with it, right? You just take that class of people, let's say petty larceny, and you look at that specific, okay, in a month-long period of the jail population, those people who are petty larceny, and then without disclosing their personal information, you just look, did they have previous records, and is that the reason they got arraigned and remanded into the jail as opposed to released, right? I mean, that to me would be highly significant, because now we're knowing that we're dealing primarily not with the appearance of what it appears to be about, but we're dealing about this kind of backlog.
And the other thing is we won't have like the Ithaca City stuff where they put somebody in their holding cell and then they sober up and they let them go. I mean, that's the only thing that we got the data for is the jail population. Susan?
I think what I'm hearing is that most of the people that are in the jail are either repeat offenders, violators of probation, or don't have enough money for bail.
That's pretty...
If we're talking about pretrial.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree with you.
I mean, that's how I got there. But I had enough money for bail.
Run through those three again.
And posted it for me.
Yeah, run through them again.
Stop the DA. What?
Run through those three again. Either can't make bail.
They're either people that are repeat offenders.
Who can't make bail.
And or violators of probation. Basically, that defines a repeat offender. Or they don't have enough money to make bail. Because I was a repeat offender. I went to the jail, and I used my credit card to post bail.
Right. And that's a lot of folks. A lot of folks we never even see.
Right.
Because at the entry point, they can get family in or they can use their credit cards. The people OAR sees are those people who can't make bail. So it's a socioeconomic divide.
There's flight risk people too, right?
That's repeat offenders in a way.
Not necessarily.
I think you're right. You could have someone...
who was given an appearance ticket and they didn't show.
Yeah, or they could have said, as he said earlier, I'm leaving, I'm moving to Florida.
Right.
You know, like, so they're, I mean, it's I don't, a very
or they're transient and they're not local.
Yeah,
right.
It's a very small percentage, but well, flight risk people potentially.
But isn't the bail set higher at flight risk?
Could be.
Well, it depends.
That's criteria.
The reason
Susan.
I say that the flight risk people are repeat offenders is just because of the population that I lived with. Everybody ran because they knew that they were going to get
sent to
prison. They were going to get sent to prison because they had priors. You know, I didn't know many innocent people who ran away.
Yeah. Eric?
What I'm looking at is that there was a chart in the PowerPoint show that we all, at least saw the paper version of, which says that for unsentenced individuals in the jail, and there were, where'd the number go? 637 such people in 2013.
The median stay in the jail was 8 days. That means half of those people stayed more than 8 days and half of them stayed less than 8 days. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the typical timeline is to actually reach resolution of the charges, but I'm assuming it's significantly more than 8 days.
I can give you
Jason. Jason could see.
I had some folks who were there longer than 21, but the cases had to do with people who were going to be on their way to diversion and were waiting for beds and
rehab.
And the only way that the judge would let them out before even entering the plea is for them to stay in and do door-to-door transport. In some cases, these folks had been given a chance previously to be released from door-to-door, and they would run or commit more crimes or whatever.
Okay, but the point I was after is that then there's a significant number of people who are staying in the jail somewhere in the range of 3 to 30 days pretrial.
I can give you actual numbers.
Okay, but I don't need the actual numbers right now.
That's 118 days is what OAR numbers are.
I'm trying to understand that there's the person who stays, let's say, 14 days in jail pretrial. What is it that makes them releasable after 14 days that didn't make them releasable after 3 days? Their case hasn't been resolved. So it seems to me that what I'm wishing for, I'm not going to get it right this second, is an understanding of what is it that keeps people in jail pretrial for those kinds of durations. If there's something that's going to make them releasable, why doesn't it kick in sooner?
Because they couldn't make bail.
Yeah, it's one big issue.
And it could be the court, the court they're in too.
Well, and what I was going to say is we just crunched the numbers.
Those are all plausible, but what I'm looking for is there's a real answer rather than what we think is probable.
Part of the reality is the court they're in, because I know I had somebody who, for petty larceny, they did two of them within 24 hours. They were out in Dryden. They couldn't make bail. They come in for the first one, there was no bail set. Then they come in for the second bail set. It wasn't actually that high. They couldn't make bail. And then coming back, even at pretrial or even before, the judge wouldn't reduce it further.
When you say petty larceny, released?
No.
The very first one they were.
They were released.
And then,
they came back
then
in again.
Within a day, they committed a second.
Within a day, they came in.
And, again, it was for something, I know you probably don't know what I'm talking
about. I know
what
you're talking about.
And then the judge sets bail the second time, but you can't make it. And I think there might have been a problem with being able to get bail with OAR because of prior history.
Oh.
And eventually, at some point, she was able to make bail because of borrowing money or
family
something.
Family stepped up or whatever.
And, the judge wouldn't reduce it no matter how many times I go in there and argue about it.
Correct.
And it wasn't, but actually, in comparison to a lot of cases, it wasn't set high.
No, it wasn't that particular one. The number that you were talking about, the median of 8 days in jail, I think that doesn't, the reason you've got such a low number is because there's so many people who come in and can do a credit card or have family come in and post bail. Mm-hmm. Because we just crunched the numbers for 2013, and OAR did 58 bails. And the length of time between when we posted bail and the bail was returned to OAR, the average was 118 days. So that
it might be different for someone who stays in jail.
It might be different for someone who stays in jail, but I'm still looking at it and going like, so you're looking at 118 days times $90 a day, and you're looking at like $11,000 of averted board out costs rather than the $6,700 we've been talking about. It's taking longer for these bails to come back. Now, I can't say because I don't have access to all the how things are disposed of. But that's the only measurement I can measure. It's a long time that people are sitting
You're
in there.
You're measuring when bail comes back?
Yeah, because that's when the case,
resolved.
It was resolved. No, you don't get your money back until the case is resolved.
Well, but that doesn't mean they sat in there for
This is someone who was bailed and they're not sitting
there. And they're not sitting there. Right. I'm just saying, but still, it gives you an idea of the length of time that people are sitting up there.
If they're not bailed.
If they're not bailed.
If those are comparable.
If they're comparable, I don't know. There may be wiggle room there.
Sorry, of, I didn't follow you. So 118 days from the time that bail was posted.
Till the bail was returned to OAR by the judge.
OAR meets with the client, finds them eligible for bail assistance, right. Pays the bail.
Right.
And then presumably at some point is the person is released.
They're released to us. We go up, we write the check, they come
okay, they're released to you, and then by the... Do you have a sense of how long it takes for the bail to come back to you as repayment?
An average of 118 days.
She's not talking about...
From the time that you guys paid
right,
it.
Right, she's not talking okay. about the time that the person's sitting in there. She's talking about the time that it takes the money to come back. They're two entirely well, different least, things. Right. Joe and then Mark.
No, I think I understand what you're saying. That people are out. So once you issue the bail, they're out. You're saying it takes 118 days... for the case to run its course.
Right.
So if they had not been able to make bail, they would have been sitting in the jail for 118 days.
Right. That makes sense, right.
That's okay. what I'm trying to...
Uh-huh.
Mark,
okay.
No, just what Joe said is that, in like with OER especially, if they post bail for a defendant who's in jail, the bail comes to our court. That bail's not returned until that case is resolved before the court.
Mm-hmm.
When that person pleads or the case is dismissed, or whatever occurs is when that bail is released back to OAR. That's what,
that's what my number is
right.
just there.
Right.
Thanks.
No, mm-hmm.
But I'm aware that in terms of the defense attorney's strategy, a responsible attorney may feel some pressure. My defendant's in jail. I want to try and get this processed as quickly as possible because that might be the only way to get him out. On the other hand, if my defendant is out on bail, then there may be strategic reasons to make the case drag on longer, either because we're gathering information or because there may be other considerations. Jason can speak to that better than I could. But so it seems to me that you can't simply translate the 118
days. No, you can't simply translate it.
No, it's, right. not, yeah, it's not simple. I mean, the thing is, like, some people want to get out of jail no matter what. They can make the decision what they want to do as far as the resolution of the case goes. We advise them what we think, and oftentimes a lot of us will say it's better to sit there and then plead guilty to something you're not guilty of. But some folks, so that's how some people resolve. But other people, we can go back at pretrial, maybe do another bail argument or something. It's kind of hard. You can't really pigeonhole anything in this.
Different in every case.
And it's different because of the circumstances of the case, but also that each defendant's different too. Mm-hmm.
Mark?
I could say, putting aside a bit of a traffic violation, but a lot of criminal cases take forever, it seems like, in court. And it's on both sides of the coin between the prosecutor and defense counsel. But typically, defense counsel, they want time to file motions, they want time to review documents, video, whatever they have, a 7, 10, 30 notices, and things of that nature, they want time. And a typical DWI may sit in my court for 5 months before it's resolved. And another point I want to bring up is I've had people where defense counsel has asked for bail, so the person can accumulate time served when it comes time to be sentenced. If the recommendation or the plea agreement is for the purpose of incarceration for 6 months or 8 months, defense counsel will ask for bail, and so the defendant can stay in jail and be serving time, basically, at that point, even though they have not been sentenced yet, so they can receive credit for time served. With that time that they're in jail.
So the time served exceeds what the sentence might have been if he'd been out of jail.
That doesn't usually happen.
Well, you just know way to know.
But that just means you take it off on the back end.
That's correct.
They've served it.
Well, yeah.
Otherwise, they'd have had it on the back end anyway.
Well, that's just another example I want to say that what happens in court.
Right. Joe?
Does that happen on felony charges? And when I was in Syracuse, I would hear that sometimes it was better to serve local time, basically, while you're awaiting the outcome of a trial.
Well, you're still...
So you're going to be sent to a state prison. Better to spend those days in a local jail than it was to spend the same days in state prison.
I can't talk a lot about cases, but there's one case where the person's currently incarcerated on bail with no objections at all from defense counsel. and the person's set to be sentenced here this month. And when he is sentenced, I believe it's going to be a 9-month sentence, and he's already served almost the full term with good time. Mm-hmm. That was a strategy brought forth by defense counsel, saying, look, you might as well stay in jail. Here's your bail, and time credit towards your time served. It doesn't happen a lot, but that's another thing to put into the mix.
Sometimes that happens when there's multiple charges. Mm-hmm. Like they might have charges in multiple courts, too, and so some of these bails you may see can be set in just multiple jurisdictions. And they're all, and we work with the DA's office to resolve everything under one sentence, but until that one sentence is issued, the other things remain open.
All right. So let's talk about next steps and try and wrap up in the next 10 minutes. I think that we're going to have to revisit this, and we definitely need the judges. We probably need Gwen, somebody from the DA's office. You want me to try to find somebody, office from the police department, city judge, who can speak about their process, which does impact the jail.
Someone from the DA's office would be very good.
Yeah, we need somebody from the DA's office. And whether it's Gwen or an ADA, I think we'll leave up to her. That's fine.
And a judge, because we need
Judge Riley, I thought
right.
was going to be here.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, just making sure that he's here, maybe.
Right. Especially, I think, because I would have liked to have been a little more pure in our mapping of this process so that we delineated where the decision points were and where the discretionary points are and where they're not. Because what we talked a lot about here tonight was there's not a lot of discretion in certain areas here. And I think we need to be clear about that and really focus on what can we control, what can't we. I also think that as we start, being able to look at some of the data, we'll be able to, either point questions better or know what we want to look at better. So are we thinking another process meeting with the city, DA, before we schedule a public hearing?
Yeah, that's a good idea, I think.
Okay. Eric?
At some point, it might be good to spend some time talking about the finer-grained nuts and bolts view of the assigned counsel process.
That's our rep,
yeah.
Jason.
Yeah.
Like do a presentation? Of how the assigned counsel works? Is that what you're asking for?
Basically.
Well, then you probably want like Julia to do it rather than one individual attorney.
Right, right.
Because she just does it for
that gets
for
you off the
hook.
Well, it expands
from
it.
From my end is simply like someone's arraigned without counsel. The court usually, they'll ask for an attorney. If they're sent to the jail, usually it comes right from your clerk. Or the judge himself, him or herself, the requests get faxed over to Julie to find an attorney. And then once she finds somebody, we're told the next appearance date and whether they're actually whether they're in jail if bail was set. And then we try to get over there within a day. If they're in jail, we'll call over first because a lot of times people will bail themselves out and they will never they'll bail themselves out, but they won't call the assigned counsel office to find out who their attorney is, and then you're playing hunt the client down at that point.
There's also the process that is a time lag, but yeah. OAR does the assigned counsel intakes.
Oh, when they're in
Yeah. At the jail, so that, and we don't work on Saturday or Sundays either, so that if someone's arrested on a Friday night, we won't do that assigned counsel affidavit that
right.
they have to fill
yeah.
out to see if they're eligible for assigned counsel till Monday.
Right.
Then it goes to Julia, and she goes through and tries to find an attorney.
Where's her office?
Center of the Center of the,
yeah. And then sometimes there's folks who you get assigned from the bench. Like if you're there mm-hmm. and someone's brought in on an arraignment and you just happen to be there, the judge will assign an attorney or one from amongst whoever's around. And then Maybe we can do bail arguments right there.
When's the next CJATI meeting that you guys are going to discuss the data?
April 23rd, Wednesday. It's the fourth Wednesday of every month, always at noon here. And all the players are here.
Wednesday, huh?
Fourth Wednesday of every month, noon.
Okay. You guys just want to say that, you know, assigned counsel is a huge asset to the courts, really is. And Julia's fantastic, and I can't speak for other court procedures, but if I do an arraignment after hours, I fax down the information right then to assigned counsel, whether it's 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, and then if it's a weekday, I'll have my clerk call at 8:30 that next morning to find out, to make sure they got the facts, and let us know as soon as possible who the assigned counsel is. They are a huge asset. And then I've used them, and I know a lot of the attorneys who do assigned counsel work, and like Jason said, I've assigned several cases from the bench. Because instead of having it, not so much for incarceration, just to make sure the defendant's rights are represented right there on the spot. I've had people come, I just had one last Tuesday, came in on a petty larceny charge, and there was an attorney in court, and I assigned that attorney right then and there for that person. So I try to move things along as fast as I can to make sure they are represented.
Okay, we will look. We're already into the other week. It's only a week and a half before CJATI. We'll have CJATI. That will give me time, April 23rd, the fourth Wednesday of every month. That will give me time to try to set something up with the city. Okay, to make sure we've got DA represent, and we'll set up a meeting thereafter. I will do the meeting wizard, and we'll, because I'm juggling two committees.
Right. So we're talking about the next round of this committee being probably when-ish?
Probably the last week of
April.
Looks like.
Okay.
After the 23rd, we can safely say, right? Because CJATI is the 23rd.
Right. And that's a Wednesday, so we're probably talking about the week after that.
Yeah. So the legislature meets the fourth Wednesday of every month.
I didn't say legislature. CJATI.
I'm asking Joe that question, actually.
No, they're Tuesday nights. They're Tuesday nights.
I thought the legislature met the same night as the